just saying in Thai there that I request permission from Venerable Ajahn Anand, Venerable Ajahn Somchai, senior monks, everyone here, and I'll speak English first, and then at the end I'll translate into Thai in abbreviated form. So it feels like, yeah, quite a... What is it? Oh, okay. Is that more audible? Okay. Yeah, so it feels like quite an honor to have Venerable Ajahn Anand invite me to speak on Dhamma a bit. So as you may know, I often translate for Ajahn Anand or other monks, so I feel like I speak to you all quite often, but usually just in the as a translator, so not as speaking in this way. So it's nice to speak to you as myself, so to speak. And speaking as a translator often, definitely feel quite a sense of camaraderie, a lot of warm-heartedness with you all, both here in person and online. Just the sense of just all being brothers and sisters on the path of Dhamma, all walking the path of Dhamma together, all being disciples of the Buddha together, disciples of Venerable Ajahn Anand together. And so for myself, there's quite a feeling of warm-heartedness and joy to see you all or recollect the practice that all of you do. Again, both here and online. For myself, whether one is a monastic or a lay person, the way I look at it is we really all experience the same basic things, same basic joys and sorrows. You know, if we get something we don't like, it's suffering. If we separate from that which we like, it's suffering. Not getting what we want is suffering. So we have all these same basic building blocks of experience. We have the human body that ages, sickens, and dies. We're all, receive the results of our karma, owners of our actions. So like this, I feel a strong sense of camaraderie, walking the path together, that we all aspire for happiness. None of us want to suffer. So I feel a lot of warmth, but also a lot of joy for all of you and for myself as well. Just the sense of mudita, sympathetic joy that we all have this, the sufficient wisdom, sufficient faith, sufficient merit to have met with a great teacher in Ajahn Anand, to meet with genuine Dhamma teachings, which I think is quite rare. You know, we read about that in the suttas as well, to have the human birth, to meet with the true Dhamma, to meet with an awakened master, something very rare and precious. So I feel a great deal of joy seeing you, or just, you know, I don't see all of you with my physical eyes, but just knowing that you're there and we're practicing together. So I thought in that spirit, I could share some stories, some reflections. I was quite touched or inspired by Wenjia's story yesterday. And talking to him afterwards, he encouraged me to share some of my own story of how I came to ordain, how I came to practice. And I was feeling a bit shy about that, but I also, for me personally, I find great benefit listening to people's stories like Wenjia. So I felt, well, it's not quite fair just to you know, not share my own story if I find so much benefit listening to others' stories. So that's one aspect, but it's a story that starts out in a kind of quite a lot of suffering. So I thought we could warm up with some aging, sickness, and death first as a way to move into the, some stories. But, you know, I noticed, particularly on this retreat, I'm not sure if it's more than before, but the topic of aging, illness, and death coming up seemingly more frequently than before. I mean, of course, it's always relevant. So I thought I would just share a few anecdotes of how I personally cultivate those reflections. Because I think sometimes, especially, you know, just looking at the chanting book here, like, I'm of the nature to age, I've not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die, I've not gone beyond dying, and so forth. I think, you know, if you have wisdom, those reflections are surely sufficient. But for myself, with perhaps some, you know, thick defilements, just doesn't quite, you know, I don't get liberated straight away just thinking about it. So I need to give myself some more avenues, some more angles on those topics to really let the truth of these statements sink into the heart, to really give rise to the actual benefit of those reflections. Because I found that one of my first thoughts about this is, well, you know, why would I want to think about this? Is it, you know, shouldn't I think about something more uplifting when I actually have time to cultivate something? You know, why would I think about aging, sickness, and death? And I'll try to expand on that point more as I continue. But just in brief, I found that if I really let these reflections sink in, the result is basically the mind disentangling from clinging to that which is impermanent and unsatisfying. And its very nature is not to bring true happiness. And that mind that's disentangling from these phenomena that don't last, the more the mind disentangles, in my experience, the more it separates or disentangles, the happier you feel, the more you feel light and at ease, you feel joy. And it's a happiness that's not dependent on gaining or having anything. So it's quite a beautiful or lofty type of happiness. So I find that's the real result of these reflections, and that's why I've come to truly love these reflections, find great value in them. So just to share a few examples of how I would practically kind of bring home the truth of these reflections. One that I like to recall is when I first came to Thailand in 2006, 2007, I was an Anagarika starting out at Wat Bananachat in Ubon Ratchathani. And for about 8 months, I lived as an Anagarika. And actually, my purpose there was to scope out places to ordain, because I knew that I wanted to ordain once I finished my education. And so in the course of that time, I had the opportunity to do a lot of meditating deep in the forest and meet a lot of great monks. And maybe I'll share some more about that later. But one of the things that happened on that 8 month time period was I learned about this monastic practice that, as I recall, it's an offense of the monastic discipline to look in the mirror unless it's to look for signs of aging or if it's related to an illness that one's looking at. And so ever since I learned that, even though I went back to live as a layperson for about 10 years, I tried to keep up that practice of looking at the mirror and to remember to look for signs of aging. which I think, at least where I lived in the USA, it's not sort of culturally promoted to, you know, embrace signs of aging. It's quite the opposite. It's more like you try to hide aging or pretend it's not happening. Or, you know, if you do see signs of aging, you try to quickly, you know, get rid of it, you know, like that. So I kind of enjoyed that going against the stream of the world, or that feeling of going against the mainstream culture. But I think back in 06, 07, I would have been 20 years old. So probably not a lot of aging signs, but the hairline starting to recede a little bit. Now it's gone quite a bit further back. You know, it just moves very slowly over time, but it's observable. And, you know, the beginnings of wrinkles, you know, like I like to smile. So nowadays it's much more observable to see some wrinkles on the face. I think back then, yeah, I couldn't gain weight no matter what I ate, but now I can. So I think that's aging related. And so I just find this, it's just a nice practical everyday thing that one can do to sort of bring home the truth of aging. Because I found that the, you know, for myself and perhaps a lot of people, but just speaking for myself, there was a sense of it was hard just to make my mind totally silent and peaceful. And it's still not easy. And I was feeling, especially after I ordained, a bit disappointed that the mind was still thinking. I thought, oh, it'd be nice if the mind was just totally serene all the time. And then Ajahn Anand gave a very helpful teaching where he pointed out that, you know, if one looks at the past, then you know, the mind was thinking quite a mixture of wholesome, unwholesome thoughts. But then now, after practicing more, it's still thinking, but it's more wholesome thoughts. And to me, this was helpful just to have a sense of, like, okay, maybe we're not able right away to just completely cease all the thinking activity of the mind, but we can harness the function of thinking for the sake of goodness, for the sake of merit, for the sake of growing in Dhamma. So in this case, it'd be thinking about, you know, aging, sickness, death, and using that capacity for thought to actually incline the mind towards a disentanglement, towards non-attachment, towards liberation. Another favorite one I do lately is I just, you know, just observe the back of my hand, actually, and just looking at the skin. Like when I was young, my skin looked different. It was a lot sort of more uniform in color, you could say. And I noticed my father's hands had all these kind of dark splotches on them. It's not really like a freckle, it's more like a large area of darker skin. Clearly I'm not a dermatologist, but these days I notice I'm getting these, you know, bigger and darker patches of color on the back of my hands. And there's just this sense of like, oh, right, yeah, that's the body aging. It's really, truly not worth clinging to, not worth taking as self. Because we all know the end game of aging, which is death, where we have to leave the body behind. And so these are just a few ways to reflect on aging that I personally find beneficial. And illness, I feel like the reflection of the nature to sicken, of the nature to have illness. Sometimes we might think, unless we have an illness currently, we might think, oh, you know, someday I could get an illness, or someday I probably will, you know, maybe thinking like this. But there was a teaching I once heard that really stuck with me, which is the body is a constant wellspring of illness. And all bodies are a constant wellspring of illness. And I'm just really reflecting on this, how can we really bring that into the heart? And to me, like an easy way to do that relates to this quote from the Dhammapada, that hunger is the foremost illness. And so I like connecting with that because we don't have to wait for some kind of diagnosis or, some kind of, heart disease or cancer or, broken bone. But hunger is something I think we all experience on a daily basis. And we might not think too much about it, or might not think it's such a severe affliction, because I hope that we all have enough food every day. So, may it be so. May we always have enough food. But, food is the medicine that allays the illness of hunger. But if we look at it, then the body really is afflicted by this illness of hunger constantly. And of course, if you have any other, there's all kinds of illnesses that people can reflect on, but that's just one that I find is quite accessible. You can also think, if you don't sleep, what's that like? You feel quite ill at ease. So again, sleep as a kind of medicine for the body, the brain, the nervous system. And if you didn't have that medicine, it'd be quite a lot of suffering. But just one occasion, it was actually right after I returned from that 2006-2007 trip in Thailand. I went back to finish my bachelor's degree in the United States. And I had contracted, like many kind of parasites or intestinal illnesses from Thailand. And the stomach was quite, whole digestive system wasn't working very well. And the doctors in the US didn't seem to understand it, or, I wasn't getting any treatment. And so one of the results of that was that I actually couldn't allay hunger. So I was always hungry, even though I had food to eat, because I couldn't seem to digest food. And it was quite a lot of suffering, just to be hungry all the time, just constantly. And nothing could alleviate it. And so I think it's, again, I wouldn't wish that experience on anybody, but, you can benefit from my having gone through it. You can reflect that, if we don't treat this illness of hunger, it is it's quite a lot of suffering. And then just to go straight into death, that very illness, kind of strangely enough, like I think it was about a few months in advance, I just had this deep sense in the mind that I was going to die soon. Not really a thought, more of like a feeling. And it came to the point where, my body kind of slowly shut down, stopped functioning. And, like the veil between worlds seemed to be growing quite thin, meaning that like unseen realms started to feel quite close by, even though I couldn't see them. It was more of like a feeling. And then it didn't come to the point where, the body just shut down. And it was actually quite peaceful because I was too tired to think, actually. So even if I tried to think, I couldn't actually be upset about anything because I was too tired to be upset. So it was very peaceful. But if anyone's learned about near-death experiences, so there was a white tunnel, a lot of love and light, some loving beings to receive oneself, and leaving the body. But of course, I came back to the body, moved on with living till the present day. I guess that was 2007. I don't know how many years ago that was. It was almost 20 years, 18 years. But Yeah, I was about 21 at the time. So I think, again, perhaps we could all learn from this experience that, life can really end at any time and we don't know when. Because normally, if we're 21 years old, finishing up university, it's kind of a time associated with good health and strength and kind of the vibrancy of youth. But for myself, it was actually the like quite a memorable or close encounter with death. And so, when the preceptor, when we have an ordination ceremony, the preceptor mentions that, oh, it's difficult to be able to ordain. And one of the reasons is because it's difficult to reach the age of 20, which is a prerequisite for higher ordination. And to me, that always strikes as very true that, yeah, it's not easy to have human life for 20 years. And then, longer than that. I mean, it's just not easy and it can end at any point. So, again, these reflections, I find them to be just very conducive towards a sense of dispassion, not clinging towards anything, particularly the body, one's life, one's health. And that sense of not clinging, I think the more you do it, the more you really get that flavor of freedom, that flavor of the happiness of not clinging. And to me, that's the real motivator behind why I like these reflections. But the next one's actually my favorite. So I think in the book here it says, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And the first time I heard this, or the first time I realized that it was my favorite, I was actually surprised at myself. I thought, why would this be my favorite? It's kind of like it feels like the worst thing I could think about. But again, there was just that sense of the word that came to mind was solace. Like this reflection just brings solace to the mind. So to me, not using a dictionary definition, but the word solace, the image that comes to mind, it's like it's putting out the fires in the mind, the fires of clinging, the fires of attaching to things as permanent and lasting and truly satisfying. Because even if we're not actively perceiving the loss of what we love, just the act of holding on to it already is a fire. It's just that when we lose it, the pain of loss is just a much more obvious fire. It's a much more kind of in your face, very apparent fire. But that's actually how I came to ordain. You could say, oh, at the time I didn't think of it that way. But looking back, when I was fairly young, there was just a day where it was like the person closest to me, also a family member, just suddenly died while we were together. Like they were kind of killed in an instant. And it just made a very strong impression on the mind. It wasn't something I could really reflect on being quite young at the time. But then once I was about 16 years old, there was another significant loss, or I lost something else that was very close to me. And so this brought up that pain from childhood, and so it's kind of like both pains at once. But this sense of like mental agony or anguish just became all-consuming at that point. Like the sense of loss was so deep and so profound that I didn't have any concepts to apply to it. Like if you asked me at that time, I wouldn't be able to explain that, oh, it's loss, it's grief, it's this or that. I didn't have that capacity. It was just that the mind was basically like all consumed with emotional pain. And so it was a very obviously difficult time. And being 16, didn't have a lot of, you know, sort of capacity to deal with this type of thing. But it, yeah, really stemmed from the loss of that which was loved and very painful. And so my feeling was that life was unlivable. You know, I couldn't live with that level of pain. It just wasn't possible. You know, just too much emotional pain. And so I really, you know, wanted a way out of that. I really wished to find a way out from that predicament. And the only thing I could actually think of at the time was to end my own life. And I didn't have any sort of wisdom or teachings that I could rely on at that time. But fortunately, a friend of mine, one day after this went on for some time, recommended to me the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. So the Mandarin speakers will probably say that differently, but that's how I say it. And it really struck me very deeply that this was something true, like I was reading something true. And I'd never encountered something that felt true before. And this just made a very profound impact on my mind. And I couldn't say it alleviated that intense emotional pain, but it kind of gave me something else to hold on to, something to, you know, something wholesome to engage with. And then fortunately, my father had a lot of Buddhist books in the house. And so I just picked up one book after another. I think starting with Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, probably read about 40 Buddhist books in the next year. But that first book, Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, had some meditation instructions. And it was just reading these little paragraphs at the end of a chapter was how I learned to meditate on that at that time. And you know, certainly wasn't like it was great every time, but I do remember one particular occasion, just in the very beginning of trying to meditate, and it was just the most, you know, serene, peaceful feeling I'd ever felt, and brought a lot of happiness with it as well. And so even though there was certainly a lot of, you know, not peaceful meditations, a lot of, you know, a lot of physical discomfort during meditation as well, but these little experiences gave me a lot of motivation to continue. So basically since that day, I've like almost never missed a day to meditate. I was just very motivated because this motivation was coming from this feeling like I didn't want to suffer, or, you know, I really needed to do something about this suffering. And so a couple years later, I was just reading a Buddhist magazine of my father's, and there was this article about a temporary ordination program at a Tibetan monastery in Nova Scotia, Canada. And as soon as I saw the pictures of the people in robes, there was just this strong feeling of like, oh, I really want to do that. So I applied for that retreat, and I was able to do that right after I finished high school. So I had a lot of, a lot of youthful enthusiasm for the Dhamma. I was very, you know, very into it. And I really enjoyed it was a month-long program where you ordain as a monk or a nun. It was about half male, half female. So half monks, half nuns on this retreat. And we practiced at the monastery overlooking the ocean there. It's quite beautiful. And I actually experienced a lot of, like, I'd never sat cross-legged in my life, basically, at that point. And that was how everyone sat. So I tried it, and almost every session was just excruciating pain. And but somehow I think of it really fondly, you know, I look at it really fondly because it just had so much goodness, so much happiness as well in the Dhamma. Like putting on the robes of the, I mean, they were Tibetan robes, but still the robes of a monastic. Like every morning there was this feeling of like being wrapped up in the love of the Buddha, the parami of the Buddha. And it brought a lot of joy. And maybe about halfway through that retreat, I had this idea to stay up late meditating after everyone had gone to bed. I was quite enjoying this kind of tranquil meditation room overlooking the ocean with all these, these nice shrines in each corner or each side. And there was just this moment, and, you know, it wasn't an enlightenment or attainment moment, but it was just some kind of experience of like a bit of a glimpse of what life is like without so much clinging, so much sense of self. And it really, this moment, whatever one wants to call it, had a very deep impact on my mind, where immediately I just felt, oh, there's nothing left for me in the world. Like all I want to do is train the mind on this path, practice on this path. And I felt that it had kind of finally answered a question that I had had in my mind since as early as I could remember, which was I really wanted to benefit beings. I wanted to somehow, you know, do good or bring benefit to others, but I didn't know how to do that. So up until that point, I had actually dedicated my life to environmental science and conservation and so on, which I still value. It's not that I don't value it, but in that moment, it just felt like, oh, this is the suitable path for me to bring benefit to myself and others. But then the teacher on that retreat, when I told her about this, so she was the preceptor and the teacher, you know, she told me, because I wanted to just ordain straight away for the rest of my life, she said, oh no, you should finish your university studies first. And I was quite kind of disappointed or shocked that, she would give that advice. Looking back on it, I think it was definitely the right advice. Maybe needed some more, some more experience in the world to know what I was giving up. But anyway, so that's what I did. I ended up going to university, and I had seen a picture of Ajahn Chah in one of these Dhamma books at one point. And as soon as I saw his picture, I just felt like, oh, he's my father in the Dhamma. Like that was the thought that arose. I didn't know why, or didn't necessarily make any kind of logical sense, but that's how I felt. And so I immediately felt like, oh, I want to go live where he lived. Very strong feeling. And so I signed up to study Thai in college once I started my college studies, and because I knew I wanted to go ordain in Thailand. And in my third year of university, the university helped me to travel to Thailand, and that's when I did that Anagarika period that I mentioned. And it was mostly just meditation. But there was one point where I went to stay at a branch, and this was before, you know, cell phones and internet were so popular. So, you just kind of hop on a bus and show up and see what it's like. You know, so I didn't know anything about this branch where I was going to. But it turned out that Ajahn Achalo was the acting abbot of Pujamgom Monastery, is what it was called, or is called. And he, as you might guess, told a lot of inspiring stories about Ajahn Anand when I stayed with him. I never heard of Ajahn Anand at that point. I just knew about the Wat Banana Chat through the books that I had read. But Ajahn Achalo, of course, recommended. He said, oh, you know, you should go see Ajahn Anand. He was a very great master. And he told, you know, all these kind of fantastical stories about Ajahn Anand's great abilities, which I find very inspiring. And these stories, you know, continue to be food for my heart up till the present day. But I did end up coming to Wat Mapchan at that point. And, you know, I showed up and I think I was just washing a foot cloth on the ground on my first day, because I was a Anagarika, so that's a normal thing to do. And I hadn't met Ajahn Anand, there was no introduction. And he just walked up to me and I just saw his feet there because I was just looking at the ground. And I just kind of looked up at him and he was just standing there. And then he just looked at me and he just said, is the way of the world good or the way of the Dhamma good? You know, tang lok di, ru tang tamat di. It was kind of like this Zen phrase. But instantly my mind just went completely silent hearing this teaching. And once my mind went totally silent hearing this, there's just this feeling of like, oh, he's my teacher for this lifetime. Again, not really like a thought, more of like a feeling arising in the mind. Because this teaching was very suitable for me in that moment, because I was, even though I had this commitment to ordain, you know, my Tibetan preceptor had suggested I, you know, finish my studies. So I was living as a student, you know, at the university. And so there's this kind of ongoing debate in my mind of, you know, should I practice as a layperson or practice as a monastic? And I was really just kind of struggling to decide, basically. But when he pointed that out to me, upon reflection, I thought, oh, he's kind of pointing out the way I should actually be thinking about this. It's not whether being a layperson is good or being a monk is good, but it is the way of the world good or the way of the Dhamma good. So to me, it was really, you know, he was pointing out, you know, the proper way to actually reflect about this. It wasn't so much about the outer form, but more of the, and of course reflecting, like, oh, right, well, of course the way of the Dhamma is the way to go. The way of the world is just, as I defined it, was just, you know, clinging and suffering and birth, aging, sickness, and death. So clearly the way of the Dhamma was what I wanted. And then afterward, he did actually just specifically say, he said, oh, you know, when you're done with your studies, come back and ordain. And so I said, okay, you know. And then I actually spent a bit longer studying than I had anticipated. I won't go into all the details, but I decided to try out living as a layperson, just to see if I could practice in that way, in a way that I felt, you know, satisfied with, or felt like, you know, that was good enough for me or what I wanted. And I think it was about maybe 10 years. And it felt, you know, it was going all right, doing retreats every year, meditating every day. I had a job at a kind of Buddhist-informed psychotherapy agency where all the employees meditate together and could go on retreat every year. So it felt, you know, pretty ideal for that type of life. And I was on retreat one day and it just hit me very strongly, like out of nowhere, that I just really missed being a monk. I just really wanted to be a monk. And I kind of thought to myself, you know, hey, like, what are you doing here? Thought, you know, get out of here. Like, I like my life. I don't want to change anything. You know, stop bothering me about this wanting to ordain again. But this thought just wouldn't leave me alone, even though I kept trying to, you know, I thought, oh, maybe if I just meditate more, maybe if I just do more retreats. And as soon as I got home from that retreat, my wife at the time, because I was married, she said, oh, you know, you want to ordain, don't you? Like she just knew somehow. And so I was committed to my precepts, so I couldn't lie. So I just said, yeah, but you know, maybe I can work something out and make this feeling go away. But the feeling just wouldn't go away. And this went on for a while, just this real struggle where there's this deep feeling of like it was time to ordain. But in my conscious mind, it was like, no, I like my life. I don't want to change it. And I asked for a sign, like, you know, just anybody, any wholesome being out there can give me a sign to help me out. And within, I think, hours, I think I just like flipped open this magazine. There was something about traveling to Thailand and, you know, and I just saw that. And I was like, okay, I got the sign, but I still can't do it, you know. And then I think there were some other signs as well. But so basically it felt pretty clear, but I just felt like I just couldn't do it, basically. And then finally I decided to do a 3-month retreat. And by the end of that retreat, I would pick one or the other and just stop thinking about it. Because the thinking about it was kind of torturous at that point. Like I was so agonizing over this decision to leave or stay that it was just too much. And so during that retreat, you know, my wife actually decided, like, okay, she wanted to live alone as well. So I thought, okay, you know, that's it. I'll go ordain then. And yeah, so again, I won't, you know, dwell on, or I won't get into that too much, but yeah, there was a lot of pain from separating from the loved once again with that one. And to be honest, part of this reflection for me was, you know, it did feel like at some point, and it took a while, it really felt like the work of a lifetime to overcome the pain of that initial loss as a child that I described. But it did feel like, yeah, you know, later on in my adulthood, through a lot of effort, which is really, that's its own whole story of, you know, using various methods to work with that kind of emotional pain and trauma. But yeah, it felt like that was like the work of a lifetime. That was quite hard, but it felt like the mind had come to some level of peace with that event. But then I could see that just coming to peace with a single event was not sufficient, because the underlying tendency to form new attachments was still there. And because that initial pain was so intense and so kind of all-consuming in terms of that anguish, there was really a really strong sense of you know, like not wanting to be heedless, like a sense of danger. Like Ajahn Anand often teaches that, you know, suffering is waiting for us. You know, illness, aging, and death is waiting for us. But it felt like, for me, it wasn't so much it was waiting for me, it's more like it already happened, and then it was going to happen again if I just let my mind follow its typical habits. Because I could see if I just let my mind do whatever it would normally do, like it would just attach to something else, and then something else, and something else, and then I would have to, you know, re-experience that pain of loss over again. So, again, like the details of my personal story may differ from yours, but I really think of this as something that unifies all of us as sentient beings. You know, we all have the same basic experience of losing what we love. Like basically aging, sickness, and death, it's just losing youth, losing health, losing life, you know, so you can put them all in the same category of losing that which one loves. So we all have that, and we all, you know, as long as we're not enlightened, we still have that tendency to form attachments. And so this is looking at it in terms of this single lifetime, and then, you know, reading the suttas, when the Buddha would say, you know, just from the loss of a mother or father, brother, sister, and so on, the tears that you have shed while wandering on the cycle of birth and death is greater than all the four oceans. And again, the sense of, yeah, it felt quite touching my heart, this teaching felt quite, just felt quite true. Of course, just in this single lifetime, the amount of tears I had shed felt quite a lot, or felt, honestly, just felt like more than enough. Felt like that was enough for all of samsara, just this, you know, few decades, that was plenty. But then reflecting on this kind of multiple lifetime perspective can bring up an even greater sense of dispassion. And so it's quite motivating to, for me to practice. And yeah, finally coming to ordain, had a quite a strong illness as well at that time. And actually a few abbots had told me I was too sick to ordain. And I had kind of actually took Wat Mopchan off my list because I knew that it was quite a steep hill here. For those of you that know the monastery, it's on a mountain, so you have to walk up a slope to get from here to there. And I was so sick, I was actually in a wheelchair for a while. I just thought, oh, that's too much, you know, so I looked for other places to ordain. But maybe it was karma. Nowadays, I look at it as a good fortune that everywhere else just said, no, you're too sick. And which I understand, I don't blame those abbots. But when I came to Ajahn Anand, finally, I just asked him, you know, where should I ordain? And my intention was just to follow whatever his advice was. So this was back in, must have been January 2017. So I'd gotten healthy enough to get on the plane to come to Thailand and, you know, sort it out, you know, basically cleared away all my worldly affairs, like, you know, finances, possessions, relationships, everything like that. So I was ready to ordain, but physically still some issues. And, you know, so I didn't ask him, can I ordain with you? Because I felt like I wasn't sure if I could do it. I just asked, where should I ordain? And Ajahn Anand just said, oh, you know, ordain at Wat Mopchan. And I just said, oh, you know, are you sure? Because, you know, I'm quite not very healthy. And he just said, as long as you're not dead, you can stay here. And I kind of thought about it. I was like, wait a minute. Okay, so if I'm dead, it's no longer an issue. So that means, yeah, I can stay at Wat Mopchan. So I felt, yeah, like very, I was very touched by his kindness and generosity to take me on. And I think as you all have heard or experienced directly, but his kindness really didn't stop there. But he, you know, would give me a lot of teachings, a lot of encouragement, a lot of kindness. And even, and this is something you might not see as a visitor, but as a resident monastic, you know, to me it was very touching, like, you know, like if I needed to go to the hospital or see a doctor, you know, he would arrange that personally, or, you know, he would, you know, find medicine personally, or, you know, he really did this, a lot of care on a very practical level. I think we all know that he cares for us in terms of the Dhamma teachings, but as a community resident, I was very touched by the kind of comprehensive care. Like they say, the great master is like a mother and a father to their disciples, so they say in the Thai language. Yeah, so it was quite a challenging time. you know, in terms of physical health, also still, you know, the sense of, you know, letting go of, you know, saying goodbye to family, friends, you know, the cat and the dog, and, you know, basically every, you know, familiar food, familiar weather, like everything familiar one has to let go to come, especially coming from the Northeast USA, it's quite different in a lot of ways. So there's a lot of, yeah, emotional pain with that, or is quite difficult mentally, but also physically, a lot of illness still. And it would come to the point where I would be in so much physical discomfort, I just felt like I really can't do this. I can't, you know, fulfill the duties of a resident. So I'll just, you know, just get a hotel for a few nights and recover, and then I'll come back. So I wasn't intent to give up on the aspiration to ordain, but I just felt like it was just too much. I needed a break. And I would really feel this way, but I felt I was actually too tired to pack my things and call a taxi. So it really felt like, oh, really miserable, you know, too tired to even go somewhere else. But when I was in this kind of like very miserable state, it's not like this happened all the time, but there was a few occasions where Ajahn Anand, he would just walk by on alms round, he would just look at me, and just all the physical and mental pain would just wash away, you know, kind of instantly, basically. And of course, you know, you can't really prove, like, why did that happen? You know, was it something he did, or, you know, just a coincidence? But in terms of, like, how I felt in my heart, and in terms of my faith, I felt like, oh, he really, I think he's helping me out with some, you know, metta, good energy. But there was a couple lessons from that. Like, one was that he doesn't do that all the time. So, you know, you have to learn to support yourself. But the other lesson for me was that, you know, if he could give me that much happiness and relief just by looking at me from a distance, you know, if I could train my mind, you know, following in his footsteps, in the footsteps of, you know, the Sangha, if I could just train my mind like he has, then I could learn to do that for myself. And to me, that felt truly inspiring and truly motivational. Because I felt like if that was just the feeling of someone giving you some kindness, then, you know, how much happiness must he have for himself? Must be truly, I think for me, kind of incomprehensible amount of freedom and happiness. So to me, that was continues to be very inspiring and uplifting to recollect. Yeah, and to this day, continue to feel very fortunate to live here, to be, you know, in close contact with Ajahn Anand, to receive teachings, and I do find it does help. But of course, you don't have to live here to get that kind of feeling, because it's really a mental act. You know, like you could be sitting right next to Ajahn Anand, but if you're just distracted, thinking about something else, then, you know, it doesn't really count for much. But, you know, if you really truly bring up the recollection of the Sangha, or could be a recollection of the Buddha, then, you know, you're close to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha in that moment, wherever you are. So I truly feel that way. And feel that, yeah, this path, you know, now that I'm living here as a monastic, I do feel that it suits me very well. So only in retrospect do I understand why I wanted to ordain so much at that time, even though I struggled with the decision. Like, now that I'm here, I felt like, oh, this is the happiest I've ever felt. You know, no wonder I wanted to come here so much. I think maybe just maybe one last little anecdote is in the very beginning, since I still had some health things, a good friend, Kubajo, Ajahn Jol took me to a doctor in Bangkok. This was very kind of him to do so. And it was a doctor who, you know, the kind of late office hours, a Chinese medicine doctor. And so it was late at night and we were waiting and there was no bathroom. So we walked to a parking garage to use the bathroom. And it was very dark, kind of in this very kind of, you know, crowded area of Bangkok. And I've never been much of a city person, never spent much time in big cities. So I was already feeling quite foreign or not my usual environment. And so we're in this parking garage, it's, you know, pretty dirty and smelly, you know, just to use the bathroom. And we had no, you know, sustenance, food or drink, or, you know, because it's afternoon, we couldn't eat anyway. And we had no place to rest either. And you know, as a monastic, you don't know, like, if you'll be offered a place to rest or food or drink. And I just remember standing there in that parking garage, and just, it was one of the most joyful feelings I'd ever felt in my life. Just this feeling of not needing anything, not needing any kind of external security, not needing any kind of external support, but just feeling like, oh, I could just sit in this, you know, dark and dirty place all night without, you know, food or water, without a place to lie down, and just feel so happy just to not need any of those things. And just this is an incredible joy. And of course, you know, that especially Thailand, but, you know, all of the, you know, the lay supporters, so generous. You know, we were taken, you know, we were well taken care of. But just that attitude of not needing to ask for anything, not needing to rely on anything, brought such intense joy. And that joy, even though that was kind of like a particularly memorable, you know, peak moment of joy, I would say that's quite, it's a consistent theme for me living here, just this joy of just not having much, not needing much, like, you know, not having the house and the car and the pets that I used to have, or the relationships and so on. Of course, you can have those things, you know, many great enlightened disciples of the Buddha had those things and were, you know, were enlightened as well to different stages. But for myself, it just, you know, the monastic life I find just suits me very, very well. And, but I think it was a bit of a taste of why the happiness of putting things down is such a great happiness. It's because it doesn't rely on having anything. So if you just put something down, then it's a kind of happiness that can just keep going because it's not relying on anything like that. So just, yeah, putting down, needing to have things, needing to rely on things, and it just brought a great deal of joy. So I think that should be sufficient for today. And really, my wish for all of us is that may these reflections, you know, truly do the work that they're intended to do in the heart. You know, may these reflections on aging, sickness, death, separation from the loved, you know, my hope for myself and all of us is that, you know, these bonds of the bonds that tie us to suffering, they can be loosened. And I think for myself, it feels like more of a gradual loosening, not like just, you know, just showing up and getting enlightened. You know, that hasn't happened. But, you know, just gradually working away and loosening these bonds of attachment. And again, I think the real motivation for me is that, just like the great masters all say, like the Buddha taught, that, you know, when you really practice, it's not that, you know, you just end with aging, sickness, and death. But these reflections, what they lead you to is that which does not age, that which does not sicken, does not die, for there's no separation, there's no coming together. It's, you know, it's a state of sublime peace and happiness is what we're all taught. And I think it's very important to have faith in that and to remember that that's the goal. And so may that inspire all of you, may that nourish all of your hearts. And I hope something shared here was helpful. And if it wasn't helpful, feel free just to put it down. But may the parami of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, all the bodhisattvas, may bless you always. May you realize freedom from suffering for your benefit and for the benefit of all beings. Sadhu.